Okay, shalom everyone. Thank you for joining us. I know everyone's busy prepping for Pesach, or their spouses are, or they are helping out. But it's great to take some time, as I mentioned in shul, to take some time to spiritually prepare, right? That's what Pesach's all about. Anyways, it's not just about throwing boiling water and blowtorches on everything. I think we all talk about blowtorches, but no one actually ever blowtorches anything. But it's good to prepare spiritually as well. So I think how we'll go, I'm going to present for around 15, 20 minutes, then Rabbi Goldberg and then Rabbi Weinstock. Hopefully just throw at you a bunch of different ideas, some short, some long, and everyone have their own style, but different people. If people are walking in, if someone could pass some source sheets if there's extra. Thank you very much. Okay, so I wanted to start off I wanted to start off at the beginning of the Seder. I want to start off at the beginning of the Seder, an idea about Kaddish. It's really a bigger idea, but something that you could say at Kaddish, you could say really at different points. The Rambam writes in the first source, in Hilchot Chametz Matzah, right, where the Rambam talks about Pesach, he says, right, some have heard this idea, it gets quoted a lot. It says, Bechol dor v'dor, in every generation, Chayav Adam leharot et atzmo, ki'ilu hu ba'atzme atza'ata mishibud Mitzrayim. So the Rambam has an interesting language. Right. Normally we say liros esatzmo, to see himself. That's what it says in the Haggadah. But the Rambam has a different language, laharot. Right. To really view, to look at oneself as if you've left Egypt. Many people have a lot to say on that. I'm not going to focus on that at all tonight. But he says here, right? Shnei Amari quotes Otanu hotzi misham. Right. Otanu, that he took, that we ourselves are supposed to view ourselves as we got out. Not that our aunt, great 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 grandfathers and grandmothers left, but we're supposed to see ourselves as if we left. Valdaber zet tziva Kadosh Baruch Hu b'Torah, and therefore God commanded us in the Bible. Vezacharta ki eved hayita. Right. You should remember that you were a slave. Kolmar ki ilu ata be'atzmecha hayita eved v'yitzata lecherut v'nafti. Right. That you should view yourself as if you were redeemed from Egypt. And this whole idea that Pesach is an experience, not just something we read about. It's interesting because, right, on Purim we also celebrate that we are saved, but we're not told to like really feel like, you know, like Haman was going to kill you. It's a different experience on Pesach. It's much more experiential than all the other holidays, because all the holidays, way we celebrate historical truths, right? On Pesach we sit in Sukkah. Right? We're supposed to feel like God's protecting us, just like they sat in Sukkah, whether it's Sukkah Mamesh, a real booth, or whether the clouds of glory, the Amnei HaKavod. And yet, some of that's more of a focus on Pesach, even though it's true for all the Chagim. Now, the Rambam continues. That was Halacha Vav, Halacha Law 6. And the Rambam continues Halacha Zayin 7, the next one. Lefichach, therefore, Keshesoet Adam B'layla Zeh. When a person feasts that night, Tzarech L'achov L'ishtot, right, you have to eat and drink. Who may save derech chayrut, and if you have to eat, you have to recline. And we know it's a way, right? It's just as free men do. Bechol echav echav bein anashim, both men and women chayav lishtot b'layla zeh arba kosot shel yayin. You're obligated to drink 4 cups on that night of wine. Right, it could be grape juice as well if wine doesn't sit well with you. Ve'ein pochtin mehem, and you may not drink less than 4. You can't drink 2. You can't drink 3. You have to drink at least 4. Right. Ve'afilu ani hamid parnes minat tzedakah. And he tells you that the amount is you have to drink a revius. And he says that even a poor person cannot drink less than 4. Right? Even the poor person is obligated to drink the full 4 cups of wine. And Rav Osner, one of the Dayanim in Bnei Brak, he takes from this, right? There's many points in here about the experiencing, about really feeling it. But I think there's a small point which could be really a larger message, which we'll try to pick on actually in a few different places throughout the Haggadah. And that is that Rav Osner, the Dayan of Bnei Brak, says that despite the hardship for this poor person to afford these 4 cups of wine, right, it's not so cheap. He has to pay for these 4 cups of wine. Hashem still wants to send that Ani the message, right? He's poor, he's downtrodden, he's distressed. But he should feel just like the Jews felt in Egypt, which is that Yeshua, which is that our Savior, right? Which that our whole lives can change like this in a moment, even in a darkest hour. Right? That even if we were in the 49th level of Tumah, the most level of impurity, even if we felt like it was almost all lost, even if we felt like we couldn't take any more of it, right? It could all change. And I think that the message for the poor person is that he should invest in these 4 cups, just like he should invest in the whole Pesach experience, as we all should, that our future can change, our mazal our can change, whatever we think is, whatever constrictions we feel we have in life, whatever bad news or troubles we're struggling with, excuse me, it can change. It can really change. It can really flip on a moment's notice, right? God has the ability to take the whole Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. He can take Mitzrayim, right? It's from the words from Meitzar, right? The constriction, whatever we feel like is holding us back. The poor person's obviously being financially held back. All of us have challenges, whether those challenges are greater or less, right? Different people with different things going on in their lives, whether it's someone at your table. Whatever is personally holding you back, you should feel like this is the Chag of Chirut. It's the Chag of Freedom. And that we should focus on how we can feel free from that. Maybe even make an action plan throughout the Seder or in the meal with your family, right? We all do the Haggadah, then we get to the meal and we talk about the playoffs. At least that's what I talk about. If you're a baseball fan, I guess nothing's going on for the next 6 months. Well, how can we use that time to really feel like whatever's holding us back spiritually, physically, emotionally? How can we focus on trying to become free of that, move past it, and really, become more free and more feeling that Hashem can change that fate? And I think there's that same idea comes up other places. You can mention that either about Kaddish, as we just mentioned, specifically about the Ani having to drink 4 cups, or what about later in the Haggadah? Right? Halach Ma'anya, the next source. Halach Ma'anya Di'achalu Av Hasana Be'ara Demitzrayim. Right? We know it's a nice song, but the tune never really works. At least in my family, it never really works. You always try to sing it, and then it just kind of dies because it only has one line. But, right? If anyone has any better tunes, please tell me afterwards. What?
Nobody knows what
I'm wearing. No. It's all like, my mom's always like, let's sing this, and then it just doesn't go anywhere. So, right, Kol Dichvin, Yasev Yechol, Kol Tzarech, Yasev Yisa, right? We said this is the bread of poverty that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. Whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever is needy, let him come and join in the Korban Pesach. Right, and the question, obviously, we all ask is, why do we say this now? Why are we in the middle of the Seder? The door might be locked or might be unlocked, but it's closed. No poor person is listening to you, unless they're like keeping their ear in their window, waiting for them to walk in. That's kind of creepy, right? So, shouldn't this say before we begin? Why don't we say this when we say that we have to start learning the laws of Pesach 30 days before, right? Why don't we say this line as part of the Purim story? Why don't after we read the Megillah, we get up and give a club instead of Shoshanas Yaakov? We'll say this line, right? We'll put on Facebook a month before Pesach. All the poor people are invited, and they'll actually be invited. Not inviting them after you already said Kiddush and you're halfway through the Seder, right? Why do we say it now? So the Eshel Beramah says that it's not directed at those people who are not at our table, right? Let's be real. Those poor people or those people who are downtrodden who aren't at our table, they're not there, right? But perhaps it's directed at either the poor people, whatever poor means, financially, emotionally, again, could be anything that's really holding us back, who are already sitting around the table. Right, it's a mitzvah to help poor people enjoy the chag. Right, that's what Maos Chitzin is all about. Right, to support those who can't afford Kimcha de Pischa, those who can't afford the Pesach. It's an expensive holiday. We help them out financially. And we're also telling them, right, if those people end up at your Seder table, we're telling them that our ancestors were also poor. Right, that our ancestors also all they could afford. One of the reasons for matzah. There's many reasons for matzah. One of the reasons for matzah is the poor man's bread. It's the cheapest thing you can make. Right, and so that's what they ate as slaves. They didn't have any money; they were slaves. Right, they were worse than poor. And look where we've come to today. We're sitting around a beautiful Seder table. And so to tell either literally a poor person or figuratively people who are struggling, people who are lacking hope, look where we came from. Right, we had nothing, and we're here. We've made it. We're sitting with our family, our friends, around a Seder table. Look how far we've come. You too can feel hope. You too can get to this place that I'm at. Or that the Jewish people as a whole are at. There is hope. Right? Redemption is possible. Don't feel like it's such a dark, like your situation is overbearing and can't change. So I think those are two similar ideas, either about the 4 cups or about the statement Halach Ma'anya that can be used to inspire a little bit of hope into the Seder. And I think it's actually the same idea is found in another place in the Haggadah. Right? We say later in the Haggadah, the next source, Hashta Hacha Lashana Haba De'arad Yisrael. Hashta Avdi Lashana Haba B'nei Chorin. Right? Say, this year, we are here. Next year, we hope to be in the land of Israel. Right? This year, we're slaves. Next year, we're free people. And the question is, what is this doing in the Haggadah at all? Right? Why are we discuss that we are slaves. What does it mean I'm slaves right now? Right? The whole reason we're having a Seder is to remember that we were slaves. If we were slaves, why do we say we are slaves? I don't think we're slaves. Right? No, we don't have any... We don't have any taskmasters right now. So why every year we say we're slaves, next year we want to be free? Right? We're not really slaves right now, so what does it mean? So Rabbi Ganak suggests in the name of Rav Soloveitchik that for most of Jewish history, Right? My grandmother, who, thank God, will be at my Seder this year, always says this every year. I'm sure she'll say it again this year. She talks about the Seder that she had in the camps, right? And that, unfortunately, for most of Jewish history, whether it was in the camps, whether it was in the Crusades, whether it was just living through the pogroms, or many, 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 many times, unfortunately, most of Jewish history, you know, people were not sitting in their beautiful 3,000-square-foot homes with the pools and palm trees in their backyard, right, reciting the Seder, right? They were living in foreign countries where they didn't feel comfortable, where they weren't really as safe as they'd like to be, where they weren't as well off as they'd like to be, and they really did feel like they weren't totally free. And so he says that we were oppressed and we were ruled over and didn't have any freedom. And so how are you supposed to sit down in the Seder and celebrate? If you really, how do you have a Seder in Auschwitz? How do you feel like you say we're free people? And the answer is you don't. You say that we're slaves and next year we'll be free. Right? And but how are you able to do that? You're able to do that based on the belief that next year we will be free. You hope for the future. You hope for a brighter tomorrow. And I saw an interesting mashal once. You could have someone sitting, let's say someone is unfortunately in jail. Right, they've served their 5-year sentence, and the next day they're getting out. And you know, if you flip the screen on the other side, you have someone sitting at home on their on their couch drinking a beer, but the next day they're getting sentenced to 5 year in jail. Who's more free? Right, the person sitting at home on the couch, or the person in jail? The person in jail is more free, because tomorrow they're getting out. The other guy might be free this moment, but he knows he's losing all his freedom. So I think perhaps the reason we say this year we're slaves is that we say, okay, I might be slaves right now, but my mindset is that I will be free. Right? My mindset is that I can overcome this. I can change I can change my path, I can change my attitude at the very least, to feel more free. And therefore, and perhaps this idea of Jewish faith, of emunah, of believing things will get better, is all part and parcel of the Seder experience. I think it's a similar idea through the four cups, or through inviting people into our Seder, right? Or through this last line, right? Either through the Halachmania or through the Hashtahacha, all these same ideas in three different permutations. The second idea I'd like to share with you is something that I think comes through the Karpas. We know that Karpas, Karpas is a fascinating part of the Seder, right? The joke is always told that you have the Karpas, and you say, well, why do I dip this thing? Right? And they say, so that the children will ask. So after the children ask, what are you supposed to say? So that you would ask? So the children ask, why do you dip it? You say, exactly, and then move on. There's obviously got to be right some more there. I don't know if we'll get fully into it tonight. But the Talmud is an interesting comment, right? The Talmud tells us, Amar Rabba bar Mechsia, Amar Rav Chama bar Goria, Amar Rav. Olam al yishne adam b'no b'en abanim. Right? It tells you good parenting advice that you should never discriminate amongst your children. Don't favor any children over the other. Why? Should be Shpiel Mishkal Shnei Slaim Milas Shenasan Yaakov LeYosef Yoser Mishar Arbanav, right? Nitkenu Bno Bo Achav Nitgal Gal Hadavar VeYerdu Avosena Meitzrayim. The Gemara tells us the danger of favoring one child over the other. That because for a few cents, right, for a few strings, that we're able to make a coat together that Yaakov gave to Yosef, right? That coat, how much? That coat. What does a coat cost? Right, a fancy coat, $200. Right? Or for the few strings that made the coat beautiful, the brothers fought, they were jealous of each other, right? They threw Yosef in the pit, Yosef ended up in Egypt, the whole nation ended up in Egypt for 200 and something years, right? Just over a few dollars of a coat. So the Gemara tells us, don't favor one child over the other, it never works out too well. The idea is suggested that why do we dip the karpas? Right? We know we take the karpas and we dip it. Why do we have the karpas is a good question. But why do we dip the karpas? And perhaps one of the reasons we dip the karpas is to remember the story of Yosef. We know Yosef's coat was dipped in blood, right? And Rabbi Weinstock spoke about this, I think, briefly on Shabbos HaGadol, that the coat is dipped in blood. And this reminds us of the Sinas Achim, of the hatred between the two brothers. That really is the reason, at least, I mean, obviously God runs the world, but at least by the Pashut Pshat of Tanakh, of reading the story, the biblical stories, we ended up in Egypt because of brotherly rivalry, because of sibling rivalry. Right, and so when we invite people to our siddurim, right? But again, we wait till so late, right? Why do we wait until now? Why do we wait until after Karpas to go ahead and invite people? Because perhaps we wait until after we've talked about the problem of Sinat Achim, after we've talked about the problem of people fighting, of not getting along, right? When we say all who are available come and eat, who's coming? Right? People who have families, people who have places to go, right? They're not coming. Right, it's the people who maybe don't fit in so well, the people who no one invited, the people who, you know, who unfortunately don't fit whatever mold we've decided is the proper way to be in society, you know, those people, you know, the people wearing the $5,000 suits on Wall Street, they already have a Seder to go to, right? It's other people. And so when we invite them into our Seder, we wait till after we've discussed this idea of fighting amongst brothers, either physical brothers in one family, right, or just the Jewish people, that we invite people who are Seder, who wouldn't normally be there, right, to join us in rectifying the Sinas Achim, to fight this unfortunate reality that still exists so much amongst the Jewish people, right, that we don't all love each other, and we judge each other based on other things than just, right, than just the important things, that we're part of the same nation with the same belief. Right? So we wait until we've mentioned this problem in Karpas, then to discuss the solution. Not only do we remember what brought us down to Egypt by dipping the Karpas, but we also try to rectify it by inviting those who maybe don't fit the mold of who our friends would be to our Seder to say, you know, the fact that we're one people is more important. And that's what's going to help rectify the situation that caused Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? That caused the Galus going down to Mitzrayim. We rectify it by bringing those type of people to our Seder. And if we don't have those, if you don't have people who might otherwise not be there, it could be in our own families. You know, I spoke about on Shabbat how it's not always so easy to have Pesach, right? Even if you just have your family, it's so wonderful to be with family. But it's also challenging. We have in our homes people living with us and sleeping under one roof who don't normally live there, who have different dietary needs, who have different waking up and going to bed schedules, right? And a lot of families and cousins and grandparents, and, you know, it's a big. And to sleep, all those people to sleep under one roof for 48 hours or for 8 days is not so simple. And perhaps one message to have, I spoke about Shabbat in a different context about fighting the Metzorah, right? What caused the Metzorah. But perhaps it's the same message here. When we say that Sinas Chinam, that hating people for no reason, of being jealous is what caused going down to Egypt, perhaps rectifying it is to work with the family, with the guests, with the Jewish people as a whole, over Pesach and specifically over the Seder to get along. Right, to make it work, to not choose every battle to fight, to think about how we can spend the Seder with the family, you know, and be mavater and not worry about every little thing, and someone says a dvar Torah you don't like, or someone speaks too long, or someone's saying, well, how can we make it work? How can we make it as Jewish people that we all get along, so that it's not only a beautiful thing, but it's also fighting the very reason we went down to Egypt, and reinforcing the reason why we're proud to be out. I think Rashi makes a similar point. Right? If you look here in the next source in Rashi, Rashi says, "V'charti es brisi Yaakov." Right? Rashi here is talking in Vayikra, Perakavav, and Rashi says something. I read in English. He says something interesting. "I'll remember my covenant with Yaakov." And so the Rashi points out that the Hebrew here for Yaakov is spelled differently. Yaakov is spelled with a vav, right? Yud ayin kuf vav vet. Right? The name of Yaakov is written in full with the letter vav. And Rashi points out that that's only true in five places throughout the Tanakh. Right, there Yaakov is spelled with the vav as opposed to without. And he says that the name Eliyahu Anavi, obviously plays a role at the Seder, right? It plays a role at a bris and other places, right? If you paid attention to the Haftorah, right, last week, right? Listen, some Minyanim people read it Eliyahu because they're so used to saying Eliyahu, but the Haftorah actually doesn't say the word Eliyahu. It says the word Eliyah, right? There's no vav. And so Rashi points out here, five places Yaakov is written with an extra vav, and there's five other places in Tanakh where Eliyahu is written without a vav. Almost as if, as Rashi says, right, Eliyahu is written defectively without a vav in five places. So Rashi suggests that Yaakov almost stole the letter vav from Eliyahu HaNavi. And why did he do that? Why did it get transferred from Eliyahu to Yaakov in these five places? It's security. It's collateral. Right? That Yaakov does it so that he will come and herald the redemption, that Eliyahu has to come. And here, Yaakov is Yisrael. Right? We know Yaakov, his other name is Yisrael. Yaakov represents the Jewish people. And that we know Eliyahu Navi is going to be the one who comes and announces Mashiach. And so Yaakov Avinu almost stole the letter Vav from Eliyahu to make him come back, so that he feels obligated to come back to the Jewish people and redeem us. Right? And that his name will be incomplete until he comes back, hopefully speedily in our days. And so, I think when we think about this idea of connecting to other Jews, right, by inviting them to Seder, by reaching out to them in different ways, we realize that that's also what makes Eliyahu present. Right? Because Vav is, what else is Vav, besides being the letter that Yaakov stole from Eliyahu? Vav is the Vav HaChibur. Right? Vav connects things. Vav means and. Right? And. That we can connect one thing to the other with a Vav. And so by connecting to other people, family, friends, Jews who aren't family and aren't necessarily friends, but should be, in the broader sense, that when we can focus on this vav, on this connection, perhaps that's one of the reasons we invite Eliyahu into our Seder. We say we want to connect to other people, and we want Eliyahu to connect to us. and bring back Mashiach. I'll just share one or two more very short ideas. The Yismach Yisrael, the Alexander Rebbe, has a beautiful idea. It says about the vegetables that we eat. It says the whole year we view vegetables as like the least important part of the meal. At least I do. Right? You know, you try to eat them, but as the Simpsons say, you don't make friends with salad. Right? So it's not necessarily the focus. It's on the side. Now, the salad is the parparis, as the Gemara says. It's the thing before the meal. It's not the real meal. It's not the meat and potatoes. But on Pesach, vegetables seem to play a very important role. Right, with the karpas, with the maror, right, as Rabbi Weinstock spoke about on the Shabbos Gadol Drasha, we even have this whole thing with the break pri adama. We say it on the karpas. We have in mind the maror. Perhaps we have to snack the whole way through because we need the bracha to last. We don't want to eat a kazayis so that it's not too much. Right, the vegetables are an important part, halachically and hashkafically, of the Haggadah. They're just there, and you can't avoid them. And we eat it first. And so too, the Alexander Rebbe suggests that people who the whole year perhaps feel low or secondary, they're like, you know, they're not at the front of the shul, their names are not being, they're not being honored at the shul dinner, their names are not on the side of the building. But at the Seder, they should feel like kings also. And we're all equal at the Seder. We all recline, we all drink the four cups, we all are invited. We should all feel chashuv. Right, we're part of God's people, we're part of the Jewish people, and we should make each other feel chashuv. We should make those members of society who don't necessarily feel that way, those members of the family who don't feel that way, we should make them feel like they're just as important as us, because they are, and that they should feel welcomed and invited. Now, very last idea. The Torah says here, maybe the second last idea, I'm seeing running out of time. The Torah says here, "Can I get arba banim dibra Torah?" Right, we know there's four sons at the Seder. All right, if you look carefully, though, there's a lot to say about the four sons. I'll just share one quick idea. Right, we know that the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam, and the Einu, the Elisha, right, the smart, the evil, the simple, the one who doesn't know what to ask. Look at the Haggadah here. I quote in front of you. You can look in your books. Rasha Mahu Omer. What does the evil son say? Ma Avodah Hazot Lachem. Right. What is this work to you? As we say, right, Lachem Velolo, to you and not to him. Because he excludes himself from the group, from the community, therefore he's a kofar, he's a heretic. You can even blunt his teeth. What do you say to him? Because of this, God took me out of Egypt. Right? Leave alone me and not you. Right? If you would have been there, you would not have been redeemed. And what do we say to the simple son? Right, we say, Sheino, I'm sorry, the one who doesn't know what to ask, skipping one, number two and number four. Sheino de Elishol, the one who doesn't know what to ask. Right? Aptachlo, you should say for him. What should you say? Shinamar Begita Levin Chabiyamahu Lemor, as the Torah tells us, on this day you should speak to your son. Right? Ba'avur zeh, Hasa Hashem li betzeiti mimitzrayim. Because of this, God took me out of Egypt. We say the exact same thing to the evil son and to the son who doesn't know what to ask. We say the quote the same pasuk to him. We say, Ba'avur zeh, because of this, God took me out of Egypt. And so I heard from Shlomo Einhorn. He suggested, why do we say the same thing? Why is it the exact same pasuk that we quote to the evil son and the one who doesn't know to ask? And he says the real key to understanding the difference is because they hear it differently. Right? That the Rasha, the evil son, he makes the drasha himself. Right? The halachic drasha. Lachem velolo. Right? To you and not to me. He excludes himself. Right? Right, so he says that he excludes himself from the Jewish people. But the one who doesn't know to ask, when we tell him this pasuk, we tell him this source from the Torah that we need to teach our children the story on the Exodus on the Seder night. Right, the pasuk doesn't say you only tell children who know how to ask. It says you tell children regardless of the fact that they know to ask. V'gadat l'bincha. It doesn't say v'gadat l'bincha sheshol mimcha. You don't only ask the child who asks. You tell your children. You tell people. You tell yourself, says the Mishnah. Even if you're having a Seder by yourself, you have to tell yourself the story. You don't need to be asked the question. Right? So the Rasha makes himself into the Rasha, claims of Einhorn. Right? He hears the same thing everyone else hears. He hears the same question that the one who doesn't know how to ask, but he chooses to exclude himself. And so I think that that's also an interesting question. What makes someone evil, right? Making someone evil, in this case, what makes the son evil? That he chooses to exclude himself. We didn't exclude him. We didn't decide that he would. Right? Why would he? He would have chosen to exclude himself, and that's why he wouldn't have been redeemed. Now he didn't have enough mitzvah points. Now he didn't have enough check marks in the scorecard. But he would have chosen to not join up, not join the group. I think that's just an interesting way of viewing the Rasha and putting a positive spin on it, you know, that we all have the chance to opt in. And by being at the Seder, we've opted in, right? We know also when you get together with family and friends, especially family at the Seder, often it's a colorful mix of people. Right? Some people are committed, some people are not committed. Some people study for the Seder on a Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, and some people have never thought about the Seder and don't even know what the word Seder means. But they've all opted in to be there. They've all chosen to be at your table or whatever table you're at. And that's a milestone in itself. That's a great thing. That they're, right? Pesach is the most widely celebrated holiday amongst the Jewish people. Right? Even though it's the hardest. Right? Jonathan Sachs makes that point. I think it's fascinating. That people have decided to be at the Seder, and so that's they've opted in. Right, so almost by definition, they're not the rush. It's just an interesting way to think about it. Finally, I've overextended my time, but the Koshel Eliyahu, right? We know that there's what's the Koshel Eliyahu? It sits in the middle of the table. No one drinks it. Isn't it Baltashchis? What's it doing there? Right? We know that the Torah tells us there's four lashonos of Geula. There's four words. There's these four words in the Torah, right? Of God taking us out of Egypt. But there, what's it with the fifth cup, right? So perhaps it has to do with the fact that there's this fifth word, right? There's a fifth word there that we're not sure, right, whether we include it or not. We're not sure whether there should be a fifth cup or not. This is a very alumdish word on the Koshel Eliyahu, not necessarily on the most inspirational Dvar Torah. But what does it mean, right, if you learn Gemara? What does the Gemara say when they don't know the answer? It says teku, right? The Gemara says teku. And so it's not exactly clear what teku means, but many suggest that it means that it's an acronym, right? That Tishbi, that Eliyahu will come and answer the question. So perhaps we call it the Koshel Eliyahu because we don't know whether or not we should drink five cups or drink four cups. So Eliyahu is the one who's going to come and answer all the sfeikos, right? Perhaps sfeikos, more complicated doubts in the world, and simple doubts, halachic disputes, where the Gemara says Eliyahu will solve them. Maybe it's called the Koshel Eliyahu, the cup of Elijah, because he's the one who's going to come and tell us, should you drink five cups or should you drink four cups? So so maybe that's why we name it after him, because we'll know when he comes and tells us, yes, you should drink it. No, you should not drink it. Good, everyone. Thank you.
How about you? Are the articles in there?
The your booklets or their
yeah.
What?
My booklets, yeah. If you didn't see them beforehand. Okay. This is actually not. I'm not speaking about this. This is actually from my shiur 2 weeks ago on the Haggadah. So this is a bonus for you to come. There's 10 or 12 Divrei Torah in there that you can take home with you. And if you have any questions, ask Rabbi Freiberg. No, just kidding. I wanted to just touch on a couple of ideas that every time I present, I try to use my old notes and then I get bored reading them, so I look at a new Haggadah. So this year's Haggadah was the Haggadah of Rav Yaakov Galinsky, and he has some very nice ideas. And then I want to, the second half, 5 minutes of that, 7 minutes of that, and then the other 7-8 minutes is going to be an idea that that I had prepared years ago from Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, which we'll talk to. Otherwise known around here as Emil Lindemann's great-grandfather. So we'll talk about that in a few moments. But first we'll talk a couple of ideas from the Haggadah. The first idea from the Haggadah, if we look on the Haggadahs you have in front of you, the Rabbi Freiberg, some of this has been mentioned, the paragraphs, but these ideas are unique to Rav Galinsky's thought. At the beginning of the Seder, maybe it's a little late, but better late than never, we invite guests. And it's an expression of our chayrut, and it's an expression of freedom. When you are a slave, you eat in order to consume calories, in order to, even your food belongs to your master, either because the master owns the food or because you're consuming calories in order to have energy to work for the master. It all belongs to the master, and you're just a kli, you're just a vehicle in order to get things done for someone else. When you are a free person, you can enjoy your meal. That's why we have courses. That's why we have an appetizer. That's why we can invite guests. Because that's why we have wine, because it's an experience of luxury. It's an experience of leisure. It's an experience of chayrut. All of the much of what we do that's unique to the Seder experience is because we're free people and we can do it the way we want to do it, not out of expediency, not out of practical need, necessity, but because of luxury, celebrating who we are now, not only through what we say, but also through what we do. And it's very hands-on, it's very The experience is extraordinarily visual and active, and the more you can do that, Hari Zeh Meshubach, and part of that is inviting guests. Rav Galinsky points out, how many matzahs do you have at your Seder? Every leader of the Seder has 3 matzahs in front of him, right? How many kazayases or how many kazaitim are in a matzah? Depends on who you are, but at most, maybe you have 4 kazaitim in each matzah. So you have three matzahs in front of you, and you have a family in front of you. So Rav Galinsky says, what if that's all the matzah you have? How many kazaitim do you have to eat at the Seder? We know that for motzi and matzah, there's an opinion that it's 2 different kazaitim, sides of an olive. Then there's a kazayit for afikomen. There's a kazayit for korech. 4 kazaitim. How can we have guests? Fine, I know. I have another pound of shmura matzah behind me. But Rav Galinsky says, understand that there are times when what you see is what you got. The leader of the Seder has 3 matzahs in front of him, and now he's bringing in more guests. Where's the matzah coming from if everyone has to eat 4 kazaitim? So Rav Galinsky, who was a maggid of the previous generation, just died 5-6 years ago, says, Me'ikra din, you only have to eat 1 kazayit. And when it comes to including other people, you don't have to be such a machmer on yourself. You eat 1 kazayit and invite 3 more people over. Tell your son and your daughter and your wife, each of us will eat 1 kazayit, and then we can have a whole lot more people over at our meal. And that's what Pesach is all about, right? It's not exclusively about what we have to do for ourselves, but part of being free is to forego some of what's available to us in order to help out a friend or neighbor or stranger. He notes that in the questions on page 39, the Manishtana, chametz and matzah, there's very little difference between the words chametz and matzah. Matzah and chametz both have the tzadi, both have the mem, and the only difference is the hay and the chet. Chametz is a chet, and matzah is a hay. The only difference is a tiny little dot, a tiny little difference between chametz and matzah. A tiny crumb, or a tiny extra moment that allows the matzah to delay, and to therefore rise, and to become chametz. The power of the moment. The power of the moment at a Seder. We often think about a Seder as 2 hours, if we're lucky, 3 hours, maybe longer, plus or minus. You know what a Seder really is? It's steps, each of which have the opportunity to be a moment of connection, of inspiration. Just like the difference between chametz and matzah is just that little bit of dio, that little bit of ink between the hay and the chet, so too the difference between a meaningful experience at the Seder and one that's less so can be just a moment. And be on the lookout. Those who are leading Seders, be on the lookout for the opportunities to create those moments. Those who are participating in a Seder, be on the lookout to feel those experiences or to contribute in a way that will make those moments, right, as an overall experience. Sometimes it seems complicated and long and drawn out, but it's really about the difference between the chametz and the matzah is just a little bit. Just a little tiny speck can make all the difference in the world. The answer to the Manishtan is Ava Dimayinu, page 41. Ava Dimayinu Leparo. What was it about being slaves to Paro? Before I do that, let's just turn to 43, where it says that had we not left Egypt, had Hashem, Ilo Hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu et Avotenu Mimitzrayim, had God not taken us out of Egypt, we and our children and our descendants would still be in Egypt. Of course, that's debatable. Would no one have come along? Would history have not unfolded in a way that the Israelites would have left Egypt in some way? Certainly possible. But the point is, what I like, the idea, Ilo Lahotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu et Avotenu, had God not done it through miracles, even had society and history unfolded in a way in which the Jews were no longer in Egypt, it would not have created the birth of the Jewish people. Right, it's when Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu bichvodo uvatzmo, when He Himself takes the Jewish people out of Egypt, not with a malach, not with an angel. Even Moshe doesn't get much mention in the Haggadah. Just very briefly, there is one hint to Moshe. Where's the hint to Moshe Rabbeinu in the Haggadah? Ani velo malach. Ani velo saraf. Ani velo hashliach. You ever wonder what, right? It's, God says, I am not an angel. God and not a fiery angel. God and not the messenger. You ever wonder why it says the messenger and not just messenger? So that itself could be a reference to Moshe, but also malach mem saraf shin hashliach. Hey, is a reference to Moshe. Hidden there, behind the scenes, but incredibly, incredibly important. Speaking of those that are behind the scenes but are incredibly important, there's a question about whether we say Shalom Aleichem when Friday night falls out on Pesach or not, or Eshet Chayil. The question is, of course, do we talk about angels in the context of the Seder when we just talked about the importance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God Himself, and the role He had in the Exodus and the redemption. Differences of opinion, either way you do it, you have whom to rely on. Eshet Chayil, whether you sing it or not, certainly the Seder is an appropriate time to give acknowledgement and recognition to the Nashim Tzidkaniot, to the righteous women that are part of our lives and our communities. Just before, I'll give credit to Larry Reese for telling me this idea. He says, V'hisha amda, right, on a couple of pages later, it says that we pick up the cup and we say, V'hisha amda, that there was something that served our purposes, page 57. This is what has stood for our ancestors. All types of explanations. What is the V'hi? Does it refer to the 6 books of the Mishnah, 5 books of the Torah, 10 commandments, 1 is Hashem? Does it reference something from before? Is it a reference to the promise, Brit Bein HaBetarim? Is it a reference to the wine, that when we pick up wine, we indicate some of the halachot of wine? One of the halachot of wine is that Yayin Nesech, we're not allowed, even though wine, for the most part, is perfectly kosher no matter where you buy it. It's just made out of grapes. So why are we so crazy about Hashgacha on wine? Because it's a rabbinic enactment. In order to maintain that differentiation and that separateness between Jews and non-Jews, that's why we have very strict laws concerning grape products and wine. And that, v'hisha amda l'avotenu v'lanu, that's what has allowed us to maintain the perpetuity of the Jewish people throughout time, maintaining our distinctness, our uniqueness. But Larry told me v'hi very simply. V'hi means and she. It's an ode to the righteous women in our lives, worthy of a toast at any point in time, but certainly surrounding the Pesach Seder, both historically, as we've talked about, I mentioned in Shabbos Hagadol, the role of righteous women in the redemption process, as well as in the preparation for Seder and elsewhere. So I had mentioned about Avadim Hayinu. I'm going to go back to that we say Avadim Hayinu Leparo, that we were slaves to Paro, and Rav Galinsky points out that what was terrible about being a slave to Paro is how Paro was a man of no convictions. He was a man of expedience. He quotes the Medrash Rabbah that says that Paro at first was unwilling to oppress the Jewish people, even though the Egyptians wanted him to. He said, I have so much appreciation for what Yosef did for us back in the day. I can't oppress the Jews. So they dethroned him. And 3 months later, he came back and said, if you give me back my crown, I'll do whatever you ask me to. And what we see, and that's just a simon, that's just an example of the fact that he was swayed by the wind. The plagues come, Paro says, you can go. A day later, he says, you can't go. Back and forth, he had no convictions. He had no convictions. Contrast that to Yosef. Yosef is a key undercurrent in the Seder. Rabbi Freiberg mentioned it by Karpas, by Dippings. Contrast Paro to Yosef. Yosef was a Jew, even in Egypt. Yosef Hayab in Mitzrayim, the Medrash says, Yosef was what Yosef was throughout his sojourn and experience in Egypt, no matter what was going on. He was a Jew, he was a man of faith, he was a man of principle, the complete opposite of what Paro was all about. And to be a slave to someone who can be turned on a dime is to never be settled. Right? Can you imagine having that type of boss? Every day, he or she tells you something completely different. It's impossible to be comfortable. And to be subjected to that attitude and to that worldview is a double tragedy. first to be a slave, and then to be a slave of somebody who's so weak in character and in principle, and so wishy-washy.
I just want to ask you something. Yeah. You say Pharaoh, wasn't this a different Pharaoh from the one that...
Difference of opinion. Two different opinions as to whether it was a different Pharaoh or the same Pharaoh with different perspective and a different decrees. So certainly if it was the same Pharaoh, that very much fits in with what we're saying. That and the night of Pesach is a night of the courage of our convictions. Think about what they did that very first Pesach. They took the sheep of the deity of the Egyptians, right? What are you willing to step up and out of your comfort zone against what the conventional wisdom might be, right? In order to stand up for our principles, for whatever those principles are. And on the Seder night, we talk about what our principles are, and we explore them and we discuss them. Very different than who Paro was, and that exacerbates the sense of joy and the sense of freedom we have as a result of the redemption. I wanted to conclude with a piece from Rav Amiel. Rav Amiel was chief rabbi of pre-state Israel. He actually, the one time Rav Soloveitchik went to Israel was to apply for the chief rabbi position in Tel Aviv, which he did not get. By the way, that's the one mistake in the Time magazine article that I gave you on Shavuos HaGadol. It says he never went to Israel. He did. He went for an interview for the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and Rav Soloveitchik lost to Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel. And Amiel Lindenbaum is a great-grandson and named after his great-grandfather. And so he has Drashot El Ami. And I just wanted to share, it's about 5 minutes, I want to share with you this idea that I came across in his Drashot about Pesach, and it's about parents and children. And he quotes the Mechilta that talks about, it's the entree into the wicked son. And it will come a time that will pass when your children will say to you, what is this service to you? And of course, we know that that's the Rasha's question. And the Mechilta says as follows. That pasuk gives us good news and bad news. Right? The bad news is that there will come a generation that will ask what's going on. They will be so distanced. They will be so... So far away, so naive about their Judaism, that they're going to ask, what's going on? I don't know it. But the good news, says the Mechilta, is that they're going to be Jewish children. Right? So they might be completely ignorant, but there'll be Jewish children there. And so he has a lengthy essay about this topic, and specifically about the rebellious child, so the rebellious child asks this question: what is this avoda for you? And the answer is v'amartem zevach pesach hu l'Hashem. Right? It's the Pesach sacrifice that God offered us. And so Rav Amiel asks, how is that an answer? Right? This child, this archetype of a Russia, says, I don't get what's going on. And you tell them, oh, it's the halacha. What's halacha? Who cares about halacha? Who cares about any of this that's going on? Right? When you have a little kid, and the little kid asks, why, and you get sick of it, and you say, because Hashem said, you hope that that's the end of the conversation. At least you get 5 minutes of quiet. That'll be good enough. But this is a well articulate young person who answering because Hashem said is not an answer. It's a non-answer. So what exactly, if you don't believe in the system or you don't know about the system, telling us that it's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch doesn't really answer the question at all. What exactly are we, how is this an answer to the question? And so Rav Amiel says, the only way to understand this answer is to understand the psychology of the rebellious child. And to understand that the reason why this child is perhaps ignorant or perhaps seemingly opposed to what's going on is because we have a very rich Jewish tradition, which is also a human tendency to be defiant and to be oppositional to whatever it is that somebody else in a position of authority is trying to tell us. Right? And so therefore, there's this obstinance. It goes all the way back, and don't try to fight it. Just try to acknowledge it. And it goes back all the time, all the way to Adam Rishon. Why is it that Adam eats from the Eitz Hadaat? Yeah, it's the woman, and it's the snake, and it's the that. You know why? Because God said, don't eat from it. And the second God said, don't eat from it, there was nothing more appealing in the entire Garden of Eden than that which God told them not to do. This is the understanding of the idea. If somebody, what's a greater, who is deserving more credit? Someone who's commanded to do something, or someone who's not commanded and does it anyway? A mitzvah v'yosa, or an eino mitzvah v'yosa? So sometimes if you listen to congratulatory dinners, or if you listen to people who get awards, it's often for doing things that you're not obligated or mandated to do. Right? They went above and beyond. No one asked them to do it, and they did it anyway. How great they should be commended and congratulated and lauded for what they did. The Torah says the other way around. The Torah says, you know what's greater? A mitzvah v'yosa. You did what you were supposed to do. Don't belittle that. Because we have a tremendous taiva, we have a tremendous yetzer hara. The second we're told we have to do something, that's exactly the one thing we don't want to do. And so, gadol mitzvah v'yosa, the person who's commanded and does it anyway, that ends up being the greater value, the greater the greater commitment, and the greater value, and so. So that's how, and by the way, that's one of the ways of understanding why Paro, we talked about Ava Dimayinu LeParo. Why was it that Paro was so oppositional? Doesn't make any sense. It was against his best interests. Right? It went against everything that, it wasn't good for him. So there's a Gemara that talks about Ki Ani Hichbadati et Leiv Paro. Understanding that it's the Ani. Because Hashem, I commanded you, that's what led to Paro's heart getting hardened. Because Paro was told this is what you have to do, so immediately Paro says, I don't want to do it. You know, it's silly. You're gonna end up in bad shape. You and your whole household and your whole kingdom. Doesn't matter. This oppositional defiance. It's part of who we are. It's part of where we, it's hardwired into us, and perhaps especially so into Jewish children. There's even a Gemara that entertains the possibility, the Gemara in Brachot Daf Tet, that entertains the possibility that when it was time for the Jews to ransack Egypt, when it was time for them to take all the loot, Moshe had to force them to do it. By the way, there's another Medrash that says when they got to the other side, they were still collecting loot, and Moshe had to pull them away there. Because once they started, they didn't want to stop. But they entertained the possibility, Talmud, that Bnei Israel didn't want it. Why? Doesn't make sense. Free money. Who doesn't want free money? Well, the second you tell me I have to take it, then already I may not be as interested. It is hardwired into who we are. And so that's what Rav Amiel says. That's the answer in the Torah. V'amartem zevach pesach l'Hashem. Why do we talk about halacha? Why do we say it's from God? Because we're saying we understand why. Acknowledge the fact that part of your distaste for this whole ritual, part of your opposition to what's going on, has nothing to do with halacha, and has nothing to do with Judaism, and has nothing to do with the Karban Pesach. It only has to do with the fact that you're being commanded to do it. And gadol mitzvah v'yosa, and it's difficult to overcome our tendency, our desire, to just say no to whatever it is that people foist upon us as being obligatory and mandatory. Acknowledge that, validate that, embrace that that's part of the situation here. That understand that tendency. And realize that you don't really have a problem with Pesach or with Halacha or with God at its essence. What you really have, you have a problem with being told what to do. And we all have a problem with being told what to do, but that doesn't stop us from embracing it and understanding why responsibility is so crucial and critical, why accountability is so necessary, why it's part of being free, right? Is being told what we're supposed to do and doing it and loving it anyway. And that's hard, but understand that, that that's part of the picture. That's part of where that's part of where the Russia is coming. And so if we go back to the Mechilta, we'll end with this. The Mechilta says the bad news is that there'll be these children that are oppositional. There'll be these children that for no other reason, other than that's what they're being told to do, will challenge us. Will challenge the system, will challenge what we're doing at the Seder night. Not due to any forbidden fruit or anything like that, but due to an inherent defiant tendency. But ultimately, there's a good news, right? What did the Mechilta say? They're going to argue. The Jews are going to be ignorant, but they're still going to be Jews. And why is that? So this is brilliant. Rav Amiel points out that the Mechilta initially says the good news is that there'll be Jewish children and grandchildren. Talks about three generations. We talk about three generations in a number of places, including the pasuk Achut Hamashulash Lo Meher Yinatek, that a three-corded string rope is not easily undone. What is it about children and grandchildren? So with this I'll end. Rav Amiel says beautifully. He says, defiance works both ways, right? So if the parent is pushing Pesach and the child is defiant, then the grand and pushing against that, then the grandchild is going to be defiant against the parent and being looked to what the grandfather did.
Common enemies.
Right? Common enemies, but also it's just this, and that's how that ensures the perpetuity of Klal Yisrael. There'll be the Jews that embrace it, and the generation that rejects it, and the generation that rejects those that reject it. And it goes, it's not always that neat, but it's a promise that the Mechilta understood. And that's why specifically three generations. You may not see it in the children, but already in the grandchildren, you're going to see some of that tendency being, directing them back towards Karban Pesach, back towards history. And thereby, so I think, you know, for the purposes of the Seder, no question, the night of the Seder is called Leil Shimurim. That's worthy of a Shabbos HaGadol Drasha in itself. Maybe next year, 2020. It sounds like a good idea. What does it mean? That it's a safe night. That Jews have always been in a precarious situation, but the Seder night is a safe night. In a lot of ways, we open the door, we say Shvo Chamatcha. I think part of it being a safe night should be one that we conduct and create environments in our Seder that it's safe space. It's a safe space that there's no question that's off limits. There's no comment that's outside, as long as it's respectful, as long as it's done with an eye towards understanding and an eye towards appreciating the night and sharing it with others. It needs to be a Leil Shimurim. It needs to be a safe, it needs to be a safe space where people can express themselves, because even if it's things we don't want to hear, remember the Mechilta. It may not be this iteration, but the next time that they're rebelling, it may be towards Torah and Mitzvot, towards the embracing the freedom that Pesach represents. Chag Kosher v'Sameach.
Wait a minute. I'll be the Afi Cohen for tonight. So. All right. Well, it's good to be the third speaker, because for those of us with ADD, so we're switching topics pretty quickly over here, so I'll be the facilitator of the ADD tonight. So what I wanted to just briefly talk about tonight, something that Rabbi Freiberg touched upon, and that's that in every generation we have to view ourselves as if we ourselves left Egypt. And we hear that all the time, not only in the Seder, but it's spoken about all the time. And the question really is just how do you do it? We're told every year to do it, but it seems like an impossible task. How can I possibly view myself as someone that actually left a place of horror when I don't live in a place of horror? And it's just a very simple, basic question. And what I'm going to be doing tonight, there's going to be a lot of questions, and I may or may not answer every question, but I think they're just, even if I don't, they're valuable questions I think that you can just bring up in your siddurim. So they're valuable to take up in and of themselves. And the source I'm going to use to answer this question is from the Pesach Matzah and Maror. This is really just going to be a focused study on that one part of the Seder. And I think it's a tremendous part. I get excited for it, and you're going to see why. Because I think the idea that comes out here that will answer the original question, you're going to see that the basic ideas over there, really the tentacles spread throughout the whole Seder. And these basic ideas are ideas that can start to answer up many questions that come up at the Seder, as long as you have this basis going for you. All right, so I'm just going to actually throw out one question now, because when I was reviewing today, I just noticed it, and I don't have an answer for it yet, so maybe you'll just bring it up. But it says, Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. Rabban Gamliel would say, Kol shelomar shlosha dvarim elu bepesach lo yatzei dechobato. If a person does not mention these three things at his Seder, he does not fulfill his obligation of those three things. Be'eluhen, and it's these things. Pesach, matzah, umar. Mention the Korban Pesach, matzah, umar. So, I find it very hard to believe that Rabban Gamliel said you literally have to, like, it's like a command. You have to say these three words. Like, if I say Pesach, matzah, umar, then I fulfilled all my mitzvot of the night. That's very hard for me to say, to believe that he actually thought that. I mean, I think what he means is that you have to study, have some idea about what these things are, and that allows you to fulfill the mitzvah properly and to the highest extent. It's just weird to me. He didn't say kol shelo like lomad. He didn't. Who doesn't learn these three things? But he says if you don't say these three things, it's as if you need. It's like a magical word. You say Pesach Matzah Mar, and all of a sudden, I fulfilled my mitzvah. It doesn't seem like that's what he's talking about. I mean, if you have the most brilliant ideas, the greatest philosophical ideas and halachic ideas about Pesach, Matzah, Mor, but I use code words. Instead of the word Pesach, I say meat. Or I say light bulb. I don't think he would say you haven't fulfilled your mitzvah properly. You know, so it's something to throw out over there. Okay, now, the thing is that the three mitzvot, these Pesach is something that was done in the time of the Bein HaMikdash, Matzah and Maror. These are really the three things I think most people would look at and say, I identify those three things as giving the identity to a Seder, to Pesach. And these are the three unique mitzvot of the holiday, and without these things, I would not feel nearly as closely as I would to the holiday without them. Okay? So it's very literally these three things that make it so unique. But it gets a little bit tricky, because, fine, you'll say Maror. Okay, so their lives, or the Jewish people's lives, were super bitter back then. And I symbolically eat Maror, because why? Because someone else had a horrible time. Not me, but someone else did. So I eat Maror, why? Because something has nothing to do with me. That's why I eat it. And the question is, so, and therefore, now what? No one really, generally, you don't really have a good answer for the and therefore, now what? Same thing with matzah. We say, why do you eat matzah? Someone says, why do you eat matzah? Well, I eat matzah because, you know, the Jewish people, they were leaving Egypt and they didn't have enough time to bake their bread, and this is what they had. And therefore, that's what they did. That's why I do it. Korban Pesach, because you were living in time the base of Migdash. Your son asked, the Torah even says, you know, your son will ask you, why are you eating the Korban Pesach? Oh, because in the time back then when all the firstborns were about to die, they did this sacrifice, put his blood on the wall, and God passed over the house, and their firstborn sons lived. And therefore, because that happened to them, not to me, but them. So that is the problem. That's why we don't have meaning behind. That's why it's hard to understand that just, you know, we have to experience what they experience, because we never really get into the and therefore question. It's the and therefore, we always do it because we symbolically say that happened historically, but because we don't bring it into our own lives in some kind of way with the and therefore, that's why it's such a difficult thing to say in each and every generation, you should view yourself as if this thing happened to you, because we're not answering the and therefore. So the purpose of tonight is just to try to answer the and therefore is about these three things. So not only am I going to attempt to give meaning behind these three things, but I'd also like to ask a question of, are these just three random events? Meaning, they were great events that happened, no question about it, during the Exodus, that we should mention we were slaves, very important. We definitely left. You know, we left with the sacrifice, and then we ate certain things. Are these, did God just like cherry pick three, you know, random events that happened throughout this whole great sequence? Or is there some kind of common denominator that threads the needle that somehow relate all three mitzvot? So that's also another very important question. Okay. Now, I think the best way to do this is to, this is what I normally do, I just ask a lot of questions. I'm going to posit, by the way, yes, there is a lot of meaning behind these three things, and yes, there is a common denominator that threads the needle in between all three of these things, and when you thread them together very neatly and nicely, it actually creates a certain foundation of Judaism that is so basic and so foundational that I think that's how it helps answer lots of questions that are always going on throughout the Haggadah. All right? So, I think the best way to do it is just look at those little paragraphs that are in there, one at a time, and I'll ask a few questions and then try to put it together. So by design, I did decide to go through certain in my own order. So I'm just going to take a matzah first. So it says, matzah zu sha'anu ochlim al shuma. So matzah, why do we eat it? Good question. Al shum shelo hispik betzekam shel avotenu lahachmitz ad shenigla alem melech machem lochem akadosh baruch hu ugyalom. Because there was not enough time for the dough of our forefathers to leaven until the point where God revealed himself, God of the King of Kings revealed himself and redeemed us. Okay, so Shanamar, and it brings a proof in the Pasuk, Vayofu Tabatzik, they bake the flour or the dough, Asher Hatziyu Mimitzrayim, which they brought in Mitzrayim, Ugot Matzot. They made these matzah cakes, kilo chametz, but it was not leavened. Ki gorshu mimitzrayim, because they were ran out of Mitzrayim. V'lo yachlu li'man mea, and they had no time to wait around for this stuff to rise. V'gam tzeda lo asu lahem, and they also didn't have time to make any kind of provisions for themselves. You know, they couldn't make cookies and snacks and all this sorts of stuff. To me, you know, matzah is really, it's called Chag HaMatzot in the Torah. It's what seemed to be a very important thing. But if you really look at it, the history of matzah is completely accidental to the whole story. The only reason why there's matzah is because the Egyptians decided that they wanted to kick out the Jews so quickly, and therefore the Jews didn't have time to bake bread. But the truth of the matter is, if the Egyptians were a little bit, you know, wishy-washy about it, said, you know, just leave, you know, leave at your own, just get out of here. But if they had that mentality, you never would have had matzah. Matzah had never been part of the whole history of the Jewish people. It's completely an accidental part of the story because the Egyptians themselves decided that they wanted to quickly get them out. So we put a lot of emphasis on a piece of food that is completely accidental to the story. So why is it? Why is matzah so important, actually? Why do we care about the event of leaving quickly and therefore not having enough time? Of what significance is that? And to tell you the truth, I mean, the way the Haggadah sets it up, it says that until God revealed himself and redeemed them. And the way, how does this part say that God revealed himself and redeemed them? God revealed himself and redeemed them when? When the Jewish people were kicked out of Egypt very quickly and didn't have enough time to bake bread. At what point in time in that Pasuk do we see anything about God revealing himself? I don't see anything. If anything, actually, I would have picked, instead of matzah, if I were to make the mitzvos, I would have actually chosen a mitzvah like, I would have taken 2 cups of water and everyone's got to walk through it. That, to me, is an expression of God revealing himself and an expression of real redemption. We really got redeemed over there. That's the moment that the Egyptians were destroyed and we were free. But you say, Michael, yeah, that's crazy. What is that? Walking through 2 cups of water, that's ridiculous. What does that have to do with you? Yeah, I'm probably that question about every single other mitzvah that we do at the Seder. So it's only because we don't happen to do that when you look at it crazy. But when you get used to it, you don't really come with fresh eyes and think of it that way. But that's really the problem over here. And okay, good. My matzah questions. Move on to Mar. Mar zesh an ochlim ashuma. So why do we eat Mar? Al shum shemeru hamitzrim et chayev otenu b'mitzrayim. because the Egyptians made our lives, our forefathers' lives better in Egypt. Our lives are great. We've got pretty good lives. Yes, there are moments in Jewish history, like the Holocaust. It's very difficult to relate to that. But for the most part, we have not been living an Egyptian-style kind of slavery in our history. Shenamar, and the pasuk says, "Vaymar chayim bavoda kasha." It says that they embittered their lives with hard work, bechomer vilbeinim, with mortars and bricks, of chol avoda basada, and all the works in the field, at kol avoda tama sharadu v'ahim b'farach, any kind of work that they would give them heavy work with. So, again, maror is pretty simple. I mean, we eat some kind of bitter food, but, romaine lettuce is not that bitter. But, again, that we use a food a lot of times that, that makes it hard to feel really bitter. That really is a simple comparison, but again, it really goes back to the original question. We're not slaves. We're not really feeling that. How am I supposed to get anything out of just symbolically doing something that I have no relationship with? Okay. Now Pesach. This is Korban Pesach. Shahayu Ochlin Bizman Shabeta Migdash Kayam. So this was the Korban Pesach, the sacrifice Pesach that we ate in the Beit HaMikdash. Al Shuma. For what reason? Al Shum Shepasach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Abatei Avoteinu B'Mitzrayim. Because God passed over the houses of our forefathers in Egypt. Shenemar, v'amartem zevach Pesach l'Hashem. This is a sacrifice of a Pesach to Hashem. Asher Pesach abatei b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim, who passed over houses in Mitzrayim. B'nakba b'Mitzrayim, when he did plagues against Mitzrayim, that batinu hitzil, and our houses he saved. Vayikudam l'ishtachav, and the whole people bowed to God. Okay, now Pesach is an interesting one. So, we really were saved, or at least the firstborn were saved, and that really was the culmination of the 10 plagues, was this sacrifice. The question is, how did that sacrifice save us? What was so special about that sacrifice that said, how did it work? How did it work? So the way it worked was that we actually chained this animal, we took an animal for 4 days and chained it to the bedposts in our houses. Okay? 4 days you had to take it. It was chained, and it was in a place where we would constantly see it. And then on that fourth day, when we determined it was a good animal, it was a kosher animal to do a sacrifice, we slaughtered it. We had its blood. We had certain branches, hyssop branches. We took it and we put it on our doorposts. Now, where on the doorpost did we put it? Wasn't on the outside of the house. It was on the inside. So, if you were living in Mitzrayim during that Makkah, you would see blood on this inner doorpost. There is no blood that could be seen on the outer doorpost. Okay? So, the question is, I thought that the whole point of this thing was that we would do the sacrifice, put the blood on the doorpost, God would see we're Jewish, and pass over our house. That's the basic understanding, right? But it's a little bit weird because, first of all, the blood's on the inside of the house, not on the outside of the house. So why is that, if it's for God to see? A very famous question that Rashi brought up, and I love it. He said, what if an Egyptian firstborn was hiding out in a Jewish person's house during the night of passing over? Would he be killed, or would he be saved?
If they drank out of the same glass during Dom, right, couldn't they... When the Egyptians drink blood and the Jews drink water?
Oh, I don't know.
They say.
They buy water from the Jews. But on the night, so what happened? If an Egyptian got word of this, a firstborn, he said, I'm going to go hide on the Jewish person's house. Would he live or would he die? He died. So why did he die? He's in the house. It's being protected, I thought. Oh, you say, so God therefore knew he was there, right? So if God knows what's going on in the house, why do you need to do this whole sacrifice? God knows. It's not a protector, so what are we doing it for?
It's all for the people.
Right, okay. So it's just an interesting thing to get over our initial preconceived notions about what was going on with this sacrifice. Okay? All right. Now I'm just going to quickly just try to go over some of the ideas over here just to answer up all these questions, and we'll see if it works. I don't know. Hopefully it works. Okay. So, as you said, the sacrifice was not for God. Putting up the blood was not for God to see anything. God knew the Egyptian was in the house. God knew the Egyptian was there. So if he knew the Egyptian was there, he'd know you're Jewish and you were there. That's not what was going on. Rabbi Weinstock had touched upon this. And really, you can see this from the Torah and also from archaeology. I'm going to first go from the Torah standpoint, but animals in the certain kind, or many animals in the Egyptian culture, were endowed with powers. They were mystical beings that they assumed had powers. And I'll just give you two examples that are open in the Torah. One is when with Joseph and his brothers. When the brothers come back down to Joseph and he still hasn't revealed himself, he invites them to have a meal together. So at that meal, what happens? It says, Vayasimo lo levado velahem levadam. So Yosef placed him by himself and them by themselves. Ulam mitzrim ha'ochlim mito levadam. And the Egyptians that were eating with them, they had their own place to eat when this whole meal happened. Separate quarters within the eating. Why? So Pasuk says, "Ki lo yuchlu an hamitrim lechol ata ivrim," because the Egyptians didn't allow themselves to ever eat with Jews. Lechol ata ivrim lechem, to eat with the Jews of bread. Ki toei vahi lemitzrayim, because it was an abomination for Egyptians to eat with them. So Unklus says, "Are lo yachlin mitzray lemechol im ivray lachma." So he says the Egyptians were not allowed to eat bread with the Jews. Ari bi'ira de mitzrayim dachlin le, because the cattle of Egyptians were gods to them. Ivrin achlin, but Jewish people would eat them. So Jewish people, as we know, our family history, we were herders. We actually controlled animals and we ate them. So it was a god to them, but it was, at least in our early history, these are things that we controlled. Okay? And the other places, I'll just say it outside, right after the plague of all the animals coming in. So Paro says to Moshe, "I give up. Go ahead. You can do your sacrifices that you asked me to do, but don't leave. Do the sacrifices in Egypt." And Moshe says, "I don't think so. I'm not doing the sacrifices here. Why? Because these animals are gods to the Egyptians, and they're going to start stoning us and start rioting if we start to sacrifice their gods in the middle of Egypt. So no, you got to let us go out so there's no casualties while this process is going on." Okay. So ultimately, and if you also want to take a look, if you ever watch any kind of Egyptian or archaeological things in National Geographic, there's no end to animals being displayed on the priests' heads. They always have animal heads on, and eagles and birds, and there was a fascination with powers ascribed to animals. Okay, so basically, in a nutshell, in order to be saved as a Jew, the only way to be saved was for you to accept that there was one non-physical creator of the universe, being God, that was displaying throughout all the plagues. And by definition, if you accept that creator, you would be willing to sacrifice any godly thing of animal, that any animal that was projected to have godly powers. And that is why the Jewish people chained up the animals for 4 days, because it had to be something where they were even willing to go against their slave masters and say, "I completely reject, I reject you as my master, but I reject your entire belief system of godliness ascribed to animals." And it was done in such a way, that's why the blood was on the inside of the house. It wasn't for God to see. It had to be in the inside so you could see and constantly be reminded that this thing that everyone said could protect me, the whole night I'm looking and saying it can't even protect itself. I completely dominated that animal for 4 days chained up to my bed, And the whole night I'm looking at the fact that this protector can protect itself, which means it's a worthless kind of power. When you have that kind of mentality, that's what saved you as a Jew, and that's the meaning of Korban Pesach. Now, if you think about it, it's not just animals that people ascribe powers to. How many other things in life do people ascribe superstitions to? Do they ascribe powers to physical objects? It's so, that's what I'm saying. That's just happened to be societally, at the time, animals were used as superstitious objects. But then nowadays, can you think of anything that might have superstitious qualities ascribed to them? Charms or anything like that? There's a lot of that goes on in today's society. So it's not an irrelevant thing that only happened then and doesn't happen now. This kind of thinking is a kind of distinctions we have to make as Jews nowadays. Okay, good. Now to matzah. Matzah. So what was the significance of matzah? It seems to be an accident of the whole story. Right? It just because the Egyptians decided to kick us out quickly. If they had not made that decision, there would be no matzah on Pesach. So the thing was, is that I was taught this idea, and I was very, very impressed. But when the Jews were about to leave Egypt, this was a crucial, crucial moment. It was a pinpoint moment, and I think Rabbi Weinstock was mentioned that sometimes the little moments, these little things, can have the biggest impacts. See, the thing is that at that moment of leaving, the Jewish people could go one way or another. They could have said, we're about to go free. I deserve to live like the Egyptians. I now should be living all the pleasures that they were living. I've been beaten down for 210 years. It's my turn now. I'm the one that's going to go to the land of all the riches and get all the goods and all the great stuff. The problem is that would not fulfill the purpose of leaving Egypt. Just to get all the goods, all the jewels, all the money, all of the good food. So what God did is that He made sure that at the moment of leaving, He revealed Himself, but in a way that was, He made sure the Egyptians kicked Him out extremely quickly so that they wouldn't have time to start trying to go after all of their pleasures, to live a life of pleasure. They might say, I've been a slave for 210 years, it's owed to me to live a little hedonistic kind of lifestyle. So God made sure that they didn't have enough time to have any kind of snacks on the way, any kind of good bread. They had to eat the basics. They had to eat the food that they, lechem oni. They had to eat the bread that they were still eating when they were slaves. So they didn't have an opportunity to give in at that moment of freedom to let loose and say, hedonism, here I come. It was blocked. So God gave a little block over there, and that's what matzah was. And that's why it says that God actually redeemed them over there. Because it's true, physically they got redeemed at Yam Suf, at the splitting of the sea, but they were really redeemed of trying to go after the hedonistic lifestyle at that moment. That was real redemption. Not to be a slave to one's instincts.
But you still have Erev out to try to convince them that it's better.
Correct.
A better life.
You're right.
And they were about to go back.
Right. This was a battle. This was a 40-year battle that they were going to have to fight. Okay. All right. So how does this all tie in now? Give a little meaning to everything. I did not leave out Maror. Don't worry. But it's going to tie in now. So you see, redemption over here does not mean we were just simply physically redeemed. It means we were redeemed out of basically distorted thinking. We came to accept the true God, one, a monotheistic religion with the creator of the universe. And that was Korban Pesach. By accepting that, and at the same time rejecting superstitious powers and godly powers, that's what saved us. Okay? That's the goal. That was the goal. The thing is that in order for a person to get to a true understanding of what it means that there is a God, it's a lengthy process and takes a lot of brain power to get there. So there are only three possible things in the entire world that can possibly interfere with that process. One, is to have mistaken beliefs, mistaken thoughts. That was the Egyptian god. Boom. There's two other things that get in the way of having of getting there. One thing is if a person lives a hedonistic lifestyle, then they won't have the energy or the capability or desire to go after those ideas. That's matzah. But there's one other thing that gets in the way of a person ever getting there, and it's beyond your control, and that is pure physical and psychological pain. People that are living in physical and psychological pain just don't have the capacity to go after meaningful things in life. And that's Mara. So Pesach, again, the idea is that Pesach is really a double-edged, it's really just two sides of the same coin. It's going after the true ideas and rejecting false ideas. But how do you, but there's other things, but it's false ideas in addition to hedonistic lifestyles, in addition to life of pain, are all the things that would possibly interfere with going after the true concepts of Judaism. And that was really what the Torah was trying to establish as a basis of our foundation. That to live your life, you have, there's a goals, but know that there are only three possible things in life. I can't think of anything else that can interfere with living a life of meaning and going for your goals of what's true and what's best for a human being. So that's really the tripod of Pesach, Matzah, Marah. And that's really the foundation of us becoming the Jewish people by understanding this basic basis of the human condition. So.
Thank you very much, everyone, for coming out. If you did not get a Haggadah.